Hello and welcome to Lectionary at Lunch here at Concordia Seminary. We will be looking today at the pericopes for the Festival of the Reformation, which many of our churches will be celebrating this coming Sunday. And the Old Testament pericope for Reformation comes from Jeremiah chapter 31, where the prophet speaks of the new covenant which God will make with His people. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. Verse 31 begins, Hine yamim bo'im ne'um Yahweh. Behold, hine, behold, yamim, days, bo'im, this is a call participle from the verb bo, are coming. The hine plus participle. The hine plus participle is oftentimes a way of introducing an imminent verb. So the days are about to come. The days are imminent. Ne'um Yahweh, declares Yahweh, or oracle of Yahweh. The karati et Beit Yisrael, the eight Beit Yehuda. The karati there is a simple vav before a perfect, so a vav consecutive perfect, and this vav consecutive perfect oftentimes is a way of introducing the main clause after a temporal clause. So we have here, behold, the days are coming, oracle of Yahweh, and you could translate this when I will karat, I will cut. Karati, the final tav on the verb karat, has assimilated with the tav of the T ending. So rather than karati, you just get karati. When I will cut et Beit Yisrael, here et is not the direct object marker, but it actually is the preposition with, which is sometimes used with karat. I will cut with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, a berit kadashah, a new covenant. Notice here, when Israel is set beside Judah, you're talking about both of the kingdoms. Sometimes Israel is used in reference to all God's people. Here in this context, when it's set alongside the house of Judah, we're talking the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom being brought back together, and God making a new covenant with them. This language of Hine Yamim Bo'im, behold the days are coming, this is not the first place in the book of Jeremiah that this language is used. It has been used on a number of occasions throughout the book. This looking forward to a particular time of hope and promise is used in Jeremiah both in terms of judgment in chapters 7, chapters 9, chapter 19, in other places, this language of behold, the days are coming is used to describe God's coming judgment on His own people. And towards the end of the book of Jeremiah, in the section on the oracles against other nations, Jeremiah 48, 49, chapter 51, here in these places, the same language, behold, the days are coming, is used to describe God's coming wrath against the nations. But it is used even more frequently in the book of Jeremiah to describe not the day of God's coming judgment, but the day of God's coming salvation, which will follow on judgment's heels. Chapter 23, behold, the days are coming when I will raise up for David a righteous branch who shall reign wisely, execute justice and righteousness. So there's this picture of a coming branch from David in the coming days. Chapter 30, verse 3, the days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will restore the fortunes of my people. He will bring them back into the land, Israel and Judah both. And just before our pericope here, in chapter 31, verse 27, we've had this same phrase as well. Behold, the days are coming, God says, and He says that as He has watched over His people to pluck up and to break down, to overthrow and destroy and to bring harm, so now the days are coming when He will watch over them to build up and to plant. And this language echoes the language from Jeremiah chapter 1, the call of Jeremiah, where God sends him out, appoints him as a prophet to the nations to do all these things, to uproot and to pluck up, to break down, to overthrow, to destroy, but also to build up and plant. In this context of our pericope, it's in the context of the days having arrived now where the tearing down and the destroying is seen in the past. He's looking forward to the time where it will be time now to build up and to plant his people. And that brings us to our passage here, verse 31 that we've just read. Behold, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with Israel and Judah. And this passage will be followed in verse 38 with another, behold, the days are coming when the city shall be rebuilt for Yahweh, the city of Jerusalem. And again in some passages which follow, chapter 33, chapter 35, etc. I think it's also very important as we look at this first verse, verse 31, to note that though these promises are directed to the house of Israel and the house of Judah, in the context of Jeremiah and this language of the days that are coming, God's purposes are explained as not merely being in the interest of the house of Israel and the house of Judah historically conceived, but that in these days which are coming, all nations will be brought and drawn to Jerusalem. They will be brought together as one people with Israel and Judah. So there's a couple of dynamics here. The house of Israel and the house of Judah will be brought together in these days which are coming. The kingdom which has been divided for so long, and in fact the northern kingdom which has already now in Jeremiah's day been dispersed, they will be brought together, but also all nations will be brought together. And a picture of that, one of the best pictures of that in the book of Jeremiah is in chapter 3, verses 16 to 19, which describes all nations coming to Jerusalem. All of that is in view then as we speak of this new covenant that God will make in the coming days with these two houses. It will not merely be with Judah and Jerusalem, but it will include all of the nations as they're brought to Jerusalem. All will be brought back, rebuilt. They will all dwell securely in Yahweh's presence, and they will live in a situation of righteousness and justice which has been brought about by the righteous branch that will sprout from David. Continuing on then, the explanation, further explanation of this new covenant, this Berit Hadashah. When we use the adjective kadashah, the feminine singular form of the adjective for new, are we talking about a renewed covenant or a brand new covenant? And as we make our way through this passage, I think we'll see that it's both. It has new characteristics because God says it's not like the old one, so it will be dissimilar, and at the same time, it will embody in very significant ways some of the same aspects as the former covenant. So there are also continuities. It's also a renewal of the old. Verse 32. Lo kabarit asher karati. It will not be kabarit like the covenant. Asher, which karati I cut. At, again, as the preposition with avotam, their fathers. And now a temporal phrase, or a temporal clause introduced by the preposition beit, b'yom hakaziki, in the day of my taking hold. This hakaziki is the hithil infinitive construct of kazak, which in the call is to be strong, but in the hithil is to seize or to take hold of. In the hithil, as to take hold of, it uses bait with its object. So we see that in the following word, b'yadam. In the day when I took hold, or the day of my taking hold of their hand, seizing their hand, l'hozitam. This is another infinitive construct, hithil infinitive construct with a lamed on the front of it, oftentimes expresses purpose. So in the day of my taking hold of their hand in order to yatsah them, in order to cause them to yatsah in the Hittil, cause them to go forth, may Eretz Mitzrayim from the land of Egypt. Asher Hema He Feru et Bariti, which they, Asher Hema, which they, He Peru, He Feru, this is the Hittil perfect of Parar, which they broke or destroyed, and now the direct object et Bariti, my covenant. This is a relative clause here, beginning with a share. And in the relative clause, it's common to have a redundant or a resumptive pronoun at the end of it to give you an idea how the relative clause is functioning. Here we don't have a resumptive pronoun, we actually have a resumptive noun. The object is given again. The which here, the asher, refers to the covenant that he made with the fathers. And so it's which they broke my covenant. So just to make clear what the asher is referring to, it repeats Bariti, my covenant. So verse 32 stands so far as simply two unfoldings or two further descriptions of the new covenant, contrasting it with the old. He'll make a new covenant, verse 31 says, and verse 32 tells us it will not be like the one which he made with the fathers, which they broke. And now the end of verse 32, V'anoki ba'alti bam, Ne'um Yahweh. And I married or was a husband, ba'alti, the verb ba'al, but I was a husband, bam, to them, or for them, oracle of Yahweh. This vav here before anoki, anytime you have a vav between clauses that introduces a non-verb, there's usually something going on besides simply a simple conjunction and. So it's probably not, and I was a husband to them. But you could make this a concessive clause, even though I was a husband to them, they broke my covenant. Or sometimes the vav before a non-verb serves to emphatically change the subject. And so you could translate it something like, but I, or but as for me, I was a husband to them, in contrast to they who broke my covenant. So they were unfaithful, in other words, but I, as for me, I was faithful to them. This verb, ba'alti, is rich here in this context. As I just said, it contrasts Yahweh's faithfulness to them. He was a husband to them with their unfaithfulness, breaking the covenant. It also evokes Israel's accountability to Yahweh. He is their husband, but with this verb, Baal, he is their husband, their master. And therefore, they should have been accountable to him, but instead they broke his covenant. It evokes Israel's apostasy by bringing into the context the word Baal, right, which was the nature of their apostasy, their idolatry, their running after the Baals and the other false gods of the nations. And so also, in this context of idolatry, it brings together the images of idolatry and marriage, or really idolatry and adultery. And in this metaphor of I was a husband to them, it shows the severity of their apostasy. It is as severe to their relationship with Yahweh as adultery is in the relationship between a husband and a wife. Verse 33. He. Anytime you have a he in Hebrew, unless it's simply introducing the direct discourse of a verb of speaking or perceiving, it's usually fairly significant to the flow of thought. And here, this he gives the reason for the dissimilarity between the covenants. He said he'll make a new covenant. Then in verse 32, he says it won't be like the covenant that he made with the fathers, which they broke. And now verse 33 begins, he, for. Why won't it be like the old one? Here's how it will be different. He zot, for this, ha barit, for this is the covenant, asher ekrot, which I will cut, preposition with, et beit Yisrael, acharei hayamim hahem. This is the covenant which I will cut with the Beit Yisrael, with the house of Israel, acharei hayamim ahem, after those days. There is a variant reading in a few Hebrew manuscripts where house of Israel here, instead of Beit, is Bani Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. In either case, the meaning is similar, although to speak of children of Israel would be, in a sense, to return to the original covenant situation of God, where all of the people were united in one great group as the children of Israel. They weren't yet the house of Israel and the house of Judah. They were still one people. This is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, Ne'um Yahweh, Oracle of Yahweh. This prepositional phrase, this temporal phrase, after those days, is a little tricky here. He said at the beginning, the days are coming when I will cut a new covenant. And now he says, this is the covenant which I will make after those days. And with a real strict reading of the time here, it almost sounds like two covenants are being made. The days are coming when I'll make a covenant, and then this is the covenant that I'll make after those covenant-making days. So really, I think it's best to look at this after those days, not strictly in terms of the days that are spoken of in verse 31, but really more broadly in terms of the days in general which are coming of the restoration of God's people, which have been spoken of in many passages, including verses 27 and following just above. After the restoration, in other words, once he's brought the people back, he's rebuilt the city, etc., this is the covenant that he'll make. So he's really talking about the same time frame now as verse 31. The middle then of verse 33. Natati, I will put, notice it's a perfect, however, I have put, and this probably goes into the category that's oftentimes described as a prophetic perfect. The prophets speak in the perfect tense of things as if they're accomplished facts, even though the context suggests that this is something that's yet to come. I will put, direct object et, Torati bekirbam, my Torah in their midst. Va'al libam et tevena, and upon their heart, their lave, I will katav it, I will write it. So we've had the cutting of the covenant, and now the writing of the Torah upon their hearts. V'hayiti lahem lelohim. Here the Vav consecutive perfect, V'hayiti, could be translated, and I will be for them as God, or I will be their God. It could also be translated, this Vav consecutive perfect, in a consecutive sense, or even a resultant sense. I'll put my Torah in their midst, I'll write it upon their hearts, so that I will be their God. Vehema, and they, Yishu li la'am, and they will be for me, or belonging to me, as a people. They will be my people. This, of course, is covenant language from the first covenant. And this language here suggests that this is not a brand new covenant that's never been seen anything like it in the world before. It very much is a renewal of the old covenant, but in some kind of a new and expanded sense. And that's what we want to look out for then. What is new about this? So far, it sounds familiar. He will be their God. They will be his people. Verse 34. Velo yelamadu od ish et re'ehu v'ish et akiv. And they will not teach. Lamad here means to learn in the call, and the PL as it is here, it means to teach. And they will not teach od, the adverb yet or still or any longer. And they will not teach any longer ish et re'ehu, a man, his friend or neighbor, v'ish et akiv, or a man, his brother, Lamor, De'u et Yahweh, saying, know Yahweh. This whole phrase is probably another resultant clause coming from God putting His Torah in their midst and writing it on their hearts. I'll write my Torah on their hearts so that, first of all, He said, so that I will be their God and they will be my people, and so that they will no longer teach one another, a man to his neighbor, a man to his brother, saying, know Yahweh. They won't have to because Yahweh has written this on their hearts. And now the final clause, again a key clause. And this last key clause gives, well, it's not the last key clause, the second to the last. Ki kulam yedu ot. For all of them, kulam is kind of like a kol, particle meaning all or every, plus am, them. Kulam, all of them, yedu, will know. Ot is the direct object marker plus first common singular pronoun. For they will all know me. Le mit ketanam. It's an interesting form. The preposition lamed plus the preposition min plus the little ones, the katon ones of them. From the smallest of them, the small ones of them, the odd and up to gedolam, the great ones of them, ne'um Yahweh. Why is it that a man won't have to teach his neighbor anymore? Because they'll all know Yahweh already. All of them, from the least to the greatest. And the final key clause gives the reason for this. Why is it, again, that they will all know Him? Well, we've already seen up above a part of the reason. He will write His Torah on their hearts. And now we have a second reason, a second grounds for this given. Ki eslach le'avonam, for I will forgive their iniquity. U le'katatam lo ezkor od, and their sin lo ezkor, I will not remember od any longer. So this final phrase explains, how is it that the people know Yahweh in such an increasingly intimate sense in this new covenant? It's grounded in His actions. It's grounded in His action of writing His Torah on their hearts, changing their hearts, and it's grounded in His action of forgiving their sins. That's how they come to know God in the new covenant. He will reveal His forgiveness and bestow His forgiveness on His people. And in doing so, He will reveal Himself in a full way to their hearts, in a way that will change their hearts. The background of Jeremiah 31 here, God having to write His statutes on their hearts, is probably best not seen against Romans 2, where it talks about the people, the Gentiles, have God's law written in their hearts. I think that's talking about a slightly different thing. The background here is in contrast to two different passages. Deuteronomy 31, which says that Moses wrote down the book of the covenant, the whole Torah of God, and gave it to the priests to read to the people every 7 years. Now the Torah won't only be written out on scrolls outside of men, but God Himself will write it in their hearts. And even more significantly, in Jeremiah 17, we hear about the hearts of God's people, which are so hardened against Yahweh that they have been inscribed. It says, you have inscribed your hearts with sin, with an iron-tipped pen, with an iron pen and a diamond tip. So their hearts were so hard that they had to use an iron pen and a diamond-tipped pen to inscribe them, and what they were inscribed with is sin. In other words, they were incorrigibly sinful. The first covenant was destined to be broken. They couldn't keep it. It was impossible. But in this new covenant, it will be based on Yahweh's actions. He is the doer of the verbs. He is the writer of the law in their heart, the forgiver of sins. And this will result in changed hearts among the people, because Yahweh is the one who has changed them. We better stop with that, and we will look forward to having Victor Raj lead us through the reading from John chapter 8.